back.
Back from where?
Took a little break.
The other place. We're back from the other place.
The other place. I'm back from the fridge.
Nice.
There we go.
Oh, hey now. Mm-hmm. So it must be afternoon, as you say.
It's after 8. Yes, yeah. It's afternoon.
It's afternoon, yeah.
So
8 a.m. Mm-hmm.
8 a.m. Yes, it's mid-afternoon. Mm-hmm. It's mid-afternoon.
Right.
I am finally taking a try at this Small Business Relief Charity IPA from Reverie. It's got a bit of a cloudy look to it.
Yeah.
Which I like. It's not hazy, but it is cloudy.
Uh-huh. We call that a brewing defect.
Ooh, nice. Interesting. This is the one with the Trident blend.
Yep.
And from Germany. And Eureka hops.
I'm a fan of Eureka. I like Eureka. It is citrusy and hoppy in terms of hoppy herbal. I think the citrusy and hoppy herbal are well balanced. But it's also got a pop of like stone fruit behind it, like peaches behind it that I really, really like. And so that's a good one. Good idea.
This is nice. It's very nice. And it's an interesting choice they made because for a beer that's going very well and they're using as a charity, I would have expected a more traditional sort of lowest common denominator IPA, for lack of a better term. And this is not. This has a really neat flavor to it.
So Trident is a blend, as you mentioned, and that's from Hopsteiner, our friends in Germany. Have a very heavy North American presence, but that is a blend of 3 different North American hops, which they do not disclose, I could guess. But because they don't disclose it, they're probably proprietary. So the folks that own the rights to those varieties really don't want anybody monkeying with them or, blending them together.
Sure.
Therefore, they don't disclose it. Mm. However, I'm a big proponent. Everybody knows this. I'm a big proponent of blending, whether it's blending hop varieties or blending other botanicals into hops to create a pellet. I think it's just good sense to add more colors to the palette for brewers. So I like the idea. And and Eureka, I think, is a brilliant hop. I like that a lot.
Yeah, this is a nice, tasty one. I like this.
Mm-hmm.
I have to get this in your hands somehow. I'm not sure how that happens.
I don't know right now. I have to take the Underground Railroad to get out to you.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. That's too bad.
The Gestapo in Wisconsin would stop me at the border. So
we can't be that far from teleportation technology at this point.
Yeah, you'd be wrong.
No.
Yeah, the laws of physics are a bitch. Not going to happen, boss.
That is a bummer. Well, anyway, good beer.
No, but I like the fact that we talked about Trident, because I think that segues nicely into the topic of German hops.
It does.
And noble hops in general.
Mm-hmm. So noble hops, Hallertauer, Herbstbrucker, I probably pronounced that wrong.
Spalt Select and Tettnanger and Saaz. And it's just like you keep going and going and going.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of them.
So the noble hops, I found it interesting because reading about this recently, I always thought that noble had something to do with the chemical composition or, I think of noble gases, that there's a reason they're called noble hops. It was a marketing term. It was a marketing term from the 80s to describe this group of German hops.
Noble gases is the only thing you remember from high school chemistry.
I remember one other thing very distinctly from high school chemistry.
Okay, what is that?
It was the day that one of my, the other students in my chemistry class blew up what was in her test tube.
Mm-hmm.
And before all of our eyes, her sweater started to dissolve.
Nice.
That is the one thing I remember about high school chemistry.
That's a good one.
Yep. She
had How far did it dissolve?
Far enough that she had to wear a lab coat for the rest of the day.
Yeah. And why wasn't she wearing a lab coat to begin with? It sounds like your school was faulty with its PPE.
You know what? As a teenager, didn't care.
That goes to my other podcast on the dark web called How to Do Cool Things with Chemistry.
Mm-hmm. No,
teasing. Maybe I should do that. I should start that.
You probably should.
That might be good. Nitrogen triiodide. Everybody needs to know that. Anyway.
All right.
So
back to noble hops.
Noble hops, yeah. The quote, noble hops, which is a marketing term to describe or differentiate hops grown and processed in Europe from everybody else. Mm-hmm. And at the time when that came up, it was North America, you know, the PNW and Japan.
Now it feels more of a German term for those classic hops.
Right.
They're low alpha, low clohumulone, high linalool, and they're spicy and herby and fruity. They're not IPA hops, typically.
Typically not, because the in the modern lexicon of IPAs, it's citrus forward, right? Mm-hmm. Piney, tropical fruit. And so the thing I take issue with in terms of benchmarking against IPAs is that the IPA acceptability range keeps moving, right? So it's sort of like, you know, I draw a line in the sand and the tide comes in and moves my line. It doesn't erase it. It just moves it 4 feet forward. And you're like, wait a minute, why? I just drew my line here. What? That doesn't make any sense. So in general, if we look at noble, quote, noble hops, what we find is a very high levels of the sesquiterpenes. So humulene and caryophyllene. I mean, if you look it online, it's going to drive you nuts because every source you find is going to say humulene and caryophyllene smell, taste, quote, hoppy.
And I'm looking that word up now. I think you said it was sexy turbines. That was the word you used
sexy
to describe
turbines.
That?
Sexy, yes, turbines? Not sexy turbines. No, sesquiterpenes.
Sesquiterpenes. Okay.
Yeah, so they are terpenes, much like turpentine that folks know about. And that's, you know, if you smell pine sol, right? That's, you're smelling a terpene, a turpentine. It smells like pine, and that's where pine resin is very heavy in terpenes. Sesquiterpenes, instead of, if turpentine was a long chain, a linear chain, sesquiterpenes are a ring form. So they form sort of a ring, six carbon rings, five or seven carbon rings. But they all have a very similar chemical attributes. They're very, very heavy compounds. So we've talked in the past about how you add hops to beer, you heat them up, some things flash off, but some of these heavier compounds are so big, right, that they can't flash off just through boiling. And the sesquiterpenes are gigantic aroma compounds. They are freight train length compounds compared to some of the more fruity floral stuff like linalool that just flashes off. So those sesquiterpenes really characterize these noble hop varieties. They're very high in that. But at the same time, on the other end of the spectrum, the noble hops tend to have high levels of a very volatile compound called farnesene. And farnesene has this very bright, sharp, green apple sort of aroma flavor to it, which makes things like Saaz and Tettnanger so very stereotypical of that variety. And it's this sort of blend of low levels of these linalool and geraniol compounds that give us sort of a floral character.
Mm-hmm.
As I've said this numerous times, Dan Carey at New Glarus calls it old lady perfume. But when you balance that with this really hoppy, herbal, almost woody kind of character from the sesquiterpenes, it makes a very, very pleasant character. That whole blend, that whole spectrum blend, is what we call noble.
And they're not used as often as they used to be, certainly.
Absolutely not, because they're not sexy. Because it's like, why would, you know, it's just like you drive around, certainly in North America, and you look at the houses that were built in the 90s, and the houses that are built now don't look anything like that. Because how boring is that? Why would we want to do anything the same way we did it back in the 90s?
Well, and in this day and age of putting a hop name on your beer, when's the last time you saw, you know, Mittelfra?
Herzbrucker.
Yep. They're, right? They're not sexy names.
No, they're not. But they are tried and true because they are very well bred, very well balanced for the types of beers that they go into. You don't build an IPA around Spalt Select. You just don't do it. It just doesn't hold up against what the expectation is and what the malt bill is and all that sort of stuff.
If I recall correctly, we did fairly well with the Tetnanger, though.
Oh, Tets and Saws? This is the James Eat Crow section of the podcast because, you know, 15 years ago when we started, I said, I'm never growing Saws, I'm never growing Tet because they're so low yielding and they're never going to grow here. And I had no reference for that other than the fact that they're hard to grow. That's what other people told me. Uh-huh. I was wrong. Turns out South Central Wisconsin is very much like the Saws region in the Czech Republic. And Tetnanger and Saws loved it to the point where, again, our friend Dan Carey at New Glarus said, these are the best Saws I have ever had. Period. Where did you get these? Are these PNW Saws? I'm like, no, I got these as rhizomes shipped internationally from the Czech Republic, from Zatesh, from the Hop Research. He's like, this is the best I've ever had, hands down. So shame on me for not doing that earlier, because that would have certainly changed the course of how we had progressed in the future. But Tets and Saws and Herzbrucker and that for those lineages, we crushed it. But other quote noble varieties were a disaster. Hmm. Like anything Halitar, Fuggle were awful. East Kent Goldings, a disaster.
Yep.
So this idea, people are like, well, you can't grow noble varieties here. Noble, to your point, Greg, is a marketing term. It has nothing to do with the appropriateness of a variety for your area. So growers don't be held back by this idea that, well, I can't grow noble hops. How do you know? I didn't know. I thought I couldn't either, but I tried it. And I found some that I could.
Mm-hmm. I had forgotten about the Fuggle. I think because we gave up so quickly
on Fuggle. That was awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Styrian Golding was another one, which is a Fuggle variant. And it's just South Central Wisconsin. Uh-uh. It couldn't handle our mildew pressure. It just died out.
Hmm.
And people said, well, James, try Sterling. If Saws doesn't work, try Sterling, which is a Saws Cascade Cross. Sterling was a shit show, and it was depressing. But the row next to it, Saws, the mother, was like, meh. So it's like, what do you guys, why was I listening to these people? Back in the day, nobody knew.
Sure.
Nobody knew.
And that's why we played around and tried a bunch of different things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So Germany, that used to be their bread and butter. Or the noble hops. And then the markets decided they wanted high alpha. They wanted hoppy. And they were in trouble. So they had to pivot and figure out some other things to do. At the same time, they were having trouble with some of those varieties. A lot of things happened at once in Germany. Temperatures started rising. Just a little bit, but just enough that it was screwing with things.
It doesn't take much.
No, it doesn't. And then they also started seeing pests and diseases that they weren't used to.
Mm-hmm.
Citrus bark cracking viroid,
mm-hmm.
Verticillium wilt, which we're familiar with.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, with higher temperatures, downy mildew.
Yep.
And what's interesting is that they've got stricter regulations around copper hydroxide and copper oxychloride than we do.
Correct. And that's because it interferes with the fermentation process. So when you can apply those fungicides and what the residue is like on those cones, because it's copper, it's going to stick around. It's not just going to evaporate. That can interfere with the fermentation process, and that's no good. And in order to stick to the Reinheitsgebot laws, we have to be careful about how much residual copper is present.
Mm-hmm. So the I'm not going to pronounce it correctly. The Reinheitsgebot laws.
Reinheitsgebot. Yep.
I've always found that fascinating, and I would hope most folks listening know what that is. But it's the German purity laws around exactly how you exactly what can go into your beer.
No, it's what you will have is you will have water, you shall have yeast, and you shall have hops and malt. And that's it. But make the beer as it should be made.
But what about all the stuff I need to make it slushy?
No. That's what we let the Yankees do. They do all these crazy things. It's awful. We will stick to our heritage and do things the way they should be done.
Excellent accent. Oh, my.
So even Reinheitsgebot is seeing its day in Germany. There are some brewers that are sticking to it, and that's fine, and they're using it more as a marketing ploy than anything else. But the flavor, the palate has changed to the consumer, and they're looking towards other opportunities. Does that mean they're loading it full of, you know, brewers, German brewers are loading their beer full of rhubarb and chocolate cake? No, they're not doing that. But they are certainly more interested in these flavors and aromas that are coming out of the North American, I hesitate, it's not really a tradition, but a trend, to breed things like whole melon or Huel melon and Mandarina Bavaria, which are exquisite hops. Mm-hmm. They are masterfully bred, which we would expect from our German friends. And they are highly sought after, and they should really be proud of what they've produced. That are, if we want to consider, quote, German hops as, quote, noble, does that include Huel melon and Mandarina Bavaria with Hallertauer Mittelfrüher and Spalt Select?
I don't know. I don't think so.
It's there's some static going on right now, mm-hmm. and it's like, where do those fall? Are they, quote, noble or not?
I will say I had a fantastic Kolsch recently, which, to your point many times before, should be a marker for a brewer who knows what they're doing, and it was a Kolsch with whole melon. So well done.
What?
What do you mean, what?
A Kolsch with whole... What?
Yeah. Very, very good.
I feel the hives breaking out of my lower back right now.
Oh, please.
I appreciate the creativity that's involved there. But if I had a Kolsch with whole melon, I'd be like, where's the Tet Saz presence? I'm assuming that wasn't the only hop that they used in that beer. But it would catch me off guard.
That was the hop they advertised.
Right, because it's sexy.
Right.
Because nobody knows what Saz means.
No.
Right?
Not anymore.
Right. So it would catch me off guard, be like, why does this taste like cantaloupe?
It was good.
Kolsch should not taste like cantaloupe.
Ah. Purist. So you did jump all the way to Mandarina Bavaria and whole melon, mm-hmm. which were in the last couple of years. In the 90s, Germany, though, did start to shift toward these high alpha hops, and Magnum probably being the most prevalent of one of the they put out there.
Yeah, Magnum is a Hallertauer variant. And they bred it. I don't know, and somebody may be able to correct me here. I don't have it right at hand what the cross is with it. But it's definitely high alpha. But it goes typically into the early boil or in the whirlpool for alpha edition. It's not something that we normally associate with a specific sensory output. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's a very, very good hop. I do enjoy Magnum as a really stout, good foundation level hop, both for bittering and carrying forth the noble character, but it's super high alpha compared to what they're used to.
It is. It was a big change for them. They did that, Hercules, Polaris, mm-hmm. and then they also started playing around with dual purpose like Pearl.
I love it.
Yep.
Perla. Perla is a great one, and that's the genetics upon which the USDA bred their triple Perla, or triple Pearl, as they call it, yep. which and in the last 5 years is the absolute shining star of open source hop genetics that have been produced.
And correct me if I'm wrong, that came lineage-wise from Northern Brewer.
Correct. Yep. So absolutely.
The family tree of all this stuff is fascinating.
Right. Which leads directly to Brewer's Gold, which leads to the wild female that was isolated in Manitoba back in the early 1900s. So this, as a plant scientist, biologist, geek, all this breeding, traditional breeding that went on is just makes me happy. Mm-hmm. But I'm very pleased that all the varieties we've talked about, even the blended varieties like Trident, are available to brewers because it adds more shades of paint to their palate. Like I talked about before, I said it's, as a brewer, how many different beers and how different can you be if your palate consists of nothing but shades of beige? Right? It's no good. Yep. You're making Bob Ross cry right now. So this idea of having all of this plethora, proprietary or otherwise, at your fingertips as brewers, it can be paralyzing.
There are so many options out there.
Yeah.
And it's really, a creative brewer will play around with all of them and see what works, like putting some whole melon into a kulsch.
Yeah, that's just wrong, and they should be crucified. Oh, anyway, I tease. I tease because I love.
Yes, of course.
That's fine, and I would drink it, and I would say, wow, this tastes like cantaloupe, and that's not what I was expecting, and I will not be having another pint of that. Mm. However, the opportunities that are available, brewers and growers should both keep in mind that as breeding takes place, that we should not expect characteristics from the parents to carry through to the offspring, because plant genetics don't work like that. And if you have something like Hallertau or Middelfruer that, you know, smells like old lady perfume, Dan Carey, and you breed that with, you know, Saaz or what have you, that you wouldn't expect that you would get a combination of those two, because it doesn't work that way. So as growers and brewers, I think we have to be open to this concept that although, Greg, as you talked, quote, noble varieties, when you start monkeying around with their genetics, they can absolutely create offspring that are uncharacteristic of the sort of marketing family their parents were placed in.
Mm-hmm. In a good way.
In a good way. Absolutely, in a good way. I take all of these things as a benefit to our grower and brewing community, and certainly our consuming community, mm-hmm. because we have an opportunity to experience things we haven't experienced before. But we shouldn't look to the lineage to expect an outcome.
Fair. Yep, very fair point. Yeah. And really the point of this conversation, this sort of history of the German hops, if they had stayed the course, if they had not pivoted, they would never have resulted in things like Pearl and Mandarina Bavaria. Again, I'm not pronouncing mm-hmm. it wrong. And yeah, so on and so fine. Forth. They have evolved in order to stay current with what the brewing community is asking for. And yet those noble hops are still there as well.
Correct.
It's about 50-50 now between mm-hmm. the high alpha and those true classic hops.
Polaris and Magnum and all those higher alpha ones. I'm a traditionalist, as everyone knows. Mm-hmm. However, I also appreciate innovation and experimentation as a scientist. So I will, to my dying breath, defend the ability to do so. However, brewers and growers would be well served to keep in mind to what I mentioned earlier, that just because you have an offspring of things that we know, that offspring most likely will not exhibit similar characteristics to his parents. So we can't expect that in our planning as we move forward. That's as sort of a public service announcement. I just want to reiterate that. Even our grower friends who are experimenting in their own backyards, right? You don't expect that because you mixed a Brewer's Gold with a Cascade that you're going to get something in between, because the genetics you're tinkering around with are enormous compared to the human genome, 3 to 4 times more complex. So why would we expect that we would get an even split down the middle? You won't.
So you're saying human cloning is easier than creating new hop varieties?
As evident in my workshop. Anyway.
Oh, Lord. Oh, boy.
How am I going to get my unholy army of the night? It has to happen somewhere.
So I think that's a great point to pivot on.
We're going to pivot now.
Speaking of dual purpose, this is a dual purpose episode.
It is a dual purpose episode, yes.
So the other thing we would like to talk about today, have you had your last word on the German hop industry? Are we good to move on?
I am happy with the German hop industry.
Excellent. As am I. As I drink my beer with Trident in it. The other topic we wanted to talk about here, a few weeks ago, we put out a brainstorming session all about COVID-19, what's going on out there. So as we record this, it's April 11th, and you know everyone's pretty much secure at home.
We're neck deep. We're neck deep.
Or neck deep. Yeah. It's we're right in the middle of it. You know, some places are hitting the top of the curve. Other places are still climbing up that steep path. There's a lot of shit going on. Pardon my French. Which is better than James's German, by the way, I'll say.
Nine.
So we wanted to talk about here. We had discussed a few weeks back the potential impact on the hop industry, and in particular on labor. How are you going to get labor to your field to harvest? Well, now that we've had a few weeks to see what's going on, you've got to prepare for the fact that you may not be able to harvest your entire field this year.
What do you do when you got to do it all and you don't have enough of yourself to do it all with?
So how do you triage, as it were, and do the most you can do with limited resources so that you don't have a total loss of a season? James, go.
That's deep. I mean, that's really deep. And there's so many variables there you have to deal with. So if you were presenting this to me as a hop grower, which you are, the first thing I would say is, who are my brewer customers that are depending on me? Right? Who are the people that are closest to me? And I need to talk to them to understand what their expectation is. First thing they're going to say is, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if I'm going to be here. I don't know what's going to happen. And be like, no, I get that. And I don't either. However, let's have a chat as small business owners and let's forget the fact that we are supplier and customer. So what is it that you anticipate? What do you think your volume's going to, I mean, are you down 50%? Are you down 80%? Are you down 20%? And how much of my crop are you consuming in your overall production? Because that tells me how instrumental I am to your need.
Yeah, you're reestablishing your demand. And even in a normal year, we've discussed the fact that whether it's a handshake or a contract agreement, nothing's guaranteed.
All those folks that said, I can never get a brewer to respond to me, blah, 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 they're too busy. They ain't got shit right now. So bug them and say, you know what? I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm trying to understand your position. That's it. Because you may end up being like, okay, I've got, you know, whatever my acreage is to harvest this year. There's a couple of perspectives here. I want to divide these in terms of my ability to produce and the expectation to deliver. So right now I'm talking about the expectation to deliver. And that is, okay, if I was talking to Scott at the Vintage, saying, what is your expectation for your required, you know, your raw ingredient needs? Have they changed given our current environment? You're likely to get a question back. Has your ability to produce been impacted by the current environment?
Mm-hmm.
So you might get some data out of them, but what is your ability? Let's say they don't change their demand. What is your ability to produce? If it's on a small scale, a couple of acres, and it's all hand labor, and you're hiring people to do that, what is your ability to do that safely and socially responsibly? That's one set of questions. I can't answer that for you. But let's say, on the worst case scenario, you have 50 acres, 20 acres. You have a lot of acres. And not only can you not get the labor to do what you need to do, but you're concerned about your customer's ability to consume. What are you going to do? What are your options, Greg? What do you do?
Well, if they're not going to be able to take the hops you're producing, then you need to look elsewhere and see who else might want it. Everyone's probably in the same boat right now. Mm-hmm. You certainly can still harvest, process, and store. We know that the shelf life for hops is quite good as long as you're storing it properly.
Mm-hmm.
Your other option is to scale back and say, you know what? I'm not harvesting all of this. It's going to save you. It's going to save you in terms of labor cost, in terms of time and everything else. You're going to lose out on the sale, certainly. But do you really go through all that effort and all that harvest if you don't have a home for those hops at the end of the day?
Right. So we have, and what that brings us to is, do I continue to operate at normal levels, producing volumes that I know the demand will be lower for? Or do I do something what we call idling? Do I idle part of the yard? Do I put that yard, do I start managing that yard in a manner that keeps it healthy, but is not focused on production? And that is something we've never talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, in the best case scenario, we don't like to think about that thing, but it can happen. So what do I have to do if I have to idle my yard, if I have to pull back because either my demand isn't there or my labor isn't there, or I don't want to hold inventory and risk it going bad? So how do I idle my yard? How do I pull back from our production that we would normally experience while keeping everybody healthy and happy so that in 2021, it's like nothing ever happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, first and foremost, to your point about checking in with your brewers, you need to figure out what parts of the yard you don't necessarily want the harvest from.
Right.
Assuming you're doing multiple varieties, which of course mm-hmm. everyone should be, what varieties are going to actually give you something that's sellable?
Right. A lot of what I hear is people say, well, I'm not going to sell those Cascade this year, so I don't have to worry about managing them. Wrong. Because everything you do this year is going to impact its productivity next year. So you still have to maintain that crop to keep them healthy. You have to continue to spray them. You have to continue to fertilize them. Blah, 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 blah. But your goal is to keep the crown happy and to keep the plant happy enough that it sets buds for the following year. You're not necessarily managing for yield. So what does that mean? Certainly for North America, at this point in time in, you know, early April, if you're concerned about what you're able to sell, and you've already talked to your brewer about what they're able to take, then what's important to you right now? Well, optimal training and burn back is not as important because you're not trying to hit the nail on the head in terms of yield. You're trying to keep that plant healthy. So I'd be less concerned about getting my plants trained at the optimum time. That buys you time from a labor standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would do is say, I don't have to be so worried about when I'm going to burn back, or do I need to burn back? Get that plant up off the ground, get it minimally trained. And by minimally, I mean 2 to 3, 4 binds is all you're after. To get them going up that twine, to keep them off the ground, to keep the mildew off of them, and keep them happy and healthy. And that's it. And then you still have your spraying to do. You still have your fungicides to do. But you're not dialing in your production, your horticulture, to maximize your production. Does that make sense?
It does. It makes a lot of sense. Because if you just let the field go, I mean, heck, think about a vegetable garden if you let that go. You've got twice the work next year to get it back up and running again. So if you don't do that bare minimum, and to your point, watching for mildew, making sure you don't have a catastrophic failure just because you're not harvesting, you're going to regret it immensely the following year.
Yeah, you've got to do the same things you would do horticulturally to protect your crop, to keep it healthy, regardless of a harvest or not. The thing that's really going to impact your ability to execute with a reduced labor force and a reduced market is getting that crop off the ground. You don't want it just to trail along the ground. That's where all the downy is. That's where all the powdery is. That's where all the verticillium and fusarium is. You got to continue to train it. You got to get it up. But the timing that you need to do that, let's say you're like, James, they're scrawling all over the ground. Can I cut them back? It's June. I'm not going to get these things trained till June, and I don't have a customer base for it. Fine. Who gives a shit? Go and mow them down and let them sprout again and put one piece of twine up in order to get them up off the ground.
Just to your point, to prevent the mildew and prevent more long-lasting damage.
Correct. Just like sort of your kids as they're out of school because all the schools are closed. You keep them on a regimen. You got to keep your plants on a regimen. But you don't have to, you're not so concerned about getting enough labor at the right time or doing X, Y, and Z the right way or tweaking your fertilizer and your fungicides at the right time in order to maximize a crop when you're expecting to, quote, idle the plant. And it's sort of like being a lazy hop farmer. I kind of swallowed a little bit before I said that. But ultimately, that's what you were talking about. It was like, we're doing that because, and if you're worth your salt as a hop producer, it's gonna hurt.
Oh, sure. You're looking at dollar bills hanging on the vine there.
And you know you're doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. But the alternative of doing nothing is way, way worse. You still keep up your irrigation schedule. It's like, well, James, do I have to keep up my fertilizer schedule at the same rate? Cut it back if you want, because we're not trying to force those plants to grow so rapidly and to such a, you know, biomass volume. Could you cut back on your fertilizer? You bet you could. Mm-hmm. But understand that whatever you do this year impacts the following year's crop. So you want a plant that's healthy enough that it puts out lots of leaves, it gets lots of solar panels out there to produce lots of sugars to go down into the crown, and that you're going to go out there at the, quote, harvest time, and you're going to decapitate those plants, whether you harvest them for flowers or not. You have to keep the same schedule. You're sort of reducing the activity based on the labor resources you have.
Yep. And that's the key, because, you know, you don't have those labor resources. The fact that you are not spending money on those labor resources, and to your point earlier, not spending that money on using all the fertilizer you would have used before, you're protecting your balance sheet, really, at that point, from the fact that you know that income is not coming in later.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. You're like, how much do I need to do to keep this as a minimally viable operation? Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yep.
So you're like, yeah, you know what? If I've got to spray every 5 days to keep the late season downy from discoloring my cones, but I know it's not going to infect my plants systemically, well, maybe you don't need every 5 or 7 days. Maybe you can do every other week. Because you're not going to get a crop off of that. But the only reason you would do this calculus is if your customers tell you to.
Now, if they all come back and say, we need the product, but you still can't get the labor, you know, you've got some decisions to make, and you've got some communication to provide.
So in that aspect, I would be looking at whatever commands the highest price point. Mm-hmm. That's where I spend my time.
I think I would balance that with your existing relationships.
Well, there's that. True. But frankly, if somebody's like, I have to have my Cascade, you're like, really? Compared to something where, you know they can go elsewhere and get that because we're falling over it. But something that's more specialized like Herzbrucker or Triple Pearl, I would spend my time there.
You just wanted to say Herzbrucker because you know I can't say Herzbrucker.
Well, that's true. Well, you did a pretty good job with that time. Right. Yeah, the laws of physics are a bitch.